It is Saturday, November 10th, 2007, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, the week in geek news, and the second half, your questions and comments of technology. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Keep in mind, the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or anybody important. Today on Geek Speak, we're covering the week in geek news, and in the second half, we're taking your calls with questions and comments of technology. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can send us email. Just go to geekspeak.org. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. GeekSpeak on KUSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computers and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is GeekSpeak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, I have Miles Elam, a Slacker geek and student. Try that again.
Good morning.
Good morning, Miles. And Sean Cleveland. Sean Cleveland is the technical marketing manager at NVIDIA.
Good morning.
Sean, we missed you last week because you were off gallivanting Europe.
Yeah, I was kind of getting around there.
And what were you covering?
We were covering a bunch of new NVIDIA technologies with the top press in Europe. But me personally, I was presenting information on a new open standard called ESA.
Well, they had me go to
a bunch of different countries, including Germany, Italy, France, and UK. So, for me, that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, was this the first time in most of these countries?
You know, I had been to a lot of these countries when I was a kid. So this is my first time there since I was 5 years old.
I don't really remember
them that well.
Yeah.
Germany I remember, but it was quite an eye-opening experience. It was fun.
Where was the best coffee?
Italy, by far. Every gas station has a coffee bar with a marble counter and bronze, you know, kicks, and they don't give you coffee in paper cups there. Everything comes to you in a nice little cup, a saucer, and you just stand there and you drink and you talk. It's very laid back and relaxed. It's very different than here. Here, you go into a coffee shop, they give it to you in a paper cup, and you go. You're in a hurry.
Next, yeah.
So it's very, very different over there. It was kind of neat. I like that.
And, you know, let's start the news out with what the technology you're covering, because it's kind of interesting. It's open standards.
Yeah, so this was announced on Monday of last week. It's called ESA. It's Enthusiast System Architecture. And it's an idea that NVIDIA has pushed, a new standard. It's open and royalty-free to provide communications to devices inside a computer that we haven't had before. So up until now, we've had PCI Express, you know, to communicate with your graphics controller, serial ATA for your hard drive. You know, everything in there's got a communication. But there is no way to communicate with your power supply or your water cooling device or your PC case, your chassis. And what we wanted to do was, this is kind of more of an enthusiast. This is for enthusiasts now. And it could certainly go to mobile space and servers and even corporate environments later. But we wanted to come up with an open protocol to communicate with these devices. And anyone who supports ESA, let's take an example, like a power supply. Mm-hmm. If a company like Tegan, and they make an ESA power supply, they can actually put a circuit board with a microcontroller inside the power supply that allows you to monitor the voltages, the currents, the power efficiency of the power supply, and the temperatures. And not only can you monitor things about these devices like you couldn't before, but you can actually control them. You can actually change the speed of the fan on the power supply. So you know how they're always notoriously loud? You could actually adjust the fan speed for the acoustics to make it quieter.
And also check the temperature of the case to make sure that you're not
That's the other thing.
Up.
With the cases, you have no idea what the temperatures are inside the cases. And any enthusiast who uses water cooling, it's got to be careful because you don't have the airflow that you typically do from your CPU cooler. So a lot of the other things around the CPU, they heat up, they get hot. Wow. Because usually the water cooler has its own independent fan that's, you know, to cool the liquid going to the CPU.
And it's spot cooling. You have to really pick the location you want to cool.
So with the ESA case, you can now monitor the hot zones in your computer. You can figure out what could possibly be going wrong.
It's interesting because you'd think, I mean, you know, we know very well how the computer talks to each other. Most people don't understand how. But really, when it comes down to a computer, it's very similar to a car in that, you know, the radiator doesn't know if the muffler is working. There's no connection in the system. And newer cars, of course, do have these sensors.
That's a great example. Think about computers right now with a lot of these new parts. It's like a car back in the 70s. Where it didn't have any of these advanced communication monitoring tools.
Even though it's the most advanced computer you have, it doesn't actually look at itself very much.
So, no. Mm-hmm. And so what we've done is this uses USB connection, and anybody can get access to this information because it's ESA. So if you take an ESA-based device, the water cooling, power supply, or the chassis for now, you can actually write software. Your own software for this, if you want. It's all an open industry standard. And it gives you an ability to control these things like you couldn't before. So it's kind of neat. You know, we got a lot of flack within NVIDIA because this is not something they're making any money on.
So we wanted to make
a better enthusiast system, right? Something that, because this is, as computers get faster, enthusiasts are overclocking. There's a lot of issues that are happening inside the case. Because of from overheating, and you don't really know if your devices are getting enough power.
Right.
So this is kind of important just to make sure that we have something stable that we can all work from moving forward.
Yeah. Well, and it's kind of cool that it isn't it makes sense that it's targeted for enthusiasts because like you and I are really into this kind of thing. We want to know what our temperatures and stuff. But it's gonna trickle down to every computer having this kind of ability so that they can be tuned better. And you know, even companies that do. Produce a computer like, let's say, HP were to do one. Now, I know that HP is on board and all that.
HP, Dell, Falcon Northwest, MainGear are all large, enthusiast gaming companies that build computers for enthusiast gamers. And they're all going to use ESA. Yeah.
All right. Well, that's pretty cool.
So,
thank you very much, Sean, for that news story.
Kind of cool.
I think I'll jump over to Mr. Elam. Miles, how are you doing today?
I'm doing quite well. Thank you very much for asking.
So, I know you've got a lot of different news items to cover, but the first thing I noticed that you showed me this morning that you're obviously excited about is you've developed an application for iPhone. You've been doing some software development. And it's a translation thing.
Yes.
Tell me about it.
It's a piece of translation software. What I'm trying to do is load up a translation from Google Translate, but not the one that people are used to, the one where you put in a whole web page and it tries to translate it poorly. no, it actually caused a diplomatic...
We'll get into that in a second.
But there's actually a not well-known piece of Google Translate, which is just basically a dictionary, and then showing related phrases, how a particular word may be used.
Uh-huh.
Now, I'm taking Spanish at the local community college, Cabrillo, and I thought, wow, I really hate carrying around this little pocket dictionary, and I have my book of 501 Spanish verbs, and I'm constantly going to one to find out the definition of a word and going to the other one to find out how to conjugate a verb, and both of them are kind of bulky.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, well, why don't I just write a program that pulls from Google Translate and then write basically some code that will conjugate verbs.
Now, because it has a pretty simple rule set. There's not many exceptions in Spanish.
Well, there are some exceptions, but I'm basically trying to teach the rules to a computer.
It's a great way to learn.
Best way to describe it.
It's a great way to learn the rules in that you have to. You're trying to make an algorithm, and then you don't have to know the special cases. You're going to know them very well,
right? And you also learn those special cases very well. That those patterns. You start learning the patterns of whenever these two letters are together, you need to put in this, or wherever there's a stress mark here, this happens.
Now this is a kind of a traditional web application that you're developing. Because that's how you develop stuff on the iPhone.
Right.
So are you going to make it public for other people to use?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. I've actually already had a few people in my Spanish class tell me they want to get a copy of it.
Yeah, I bet.
Dawn was just telling me she wants to be a beta tester, so I'm sure I'll get some.
Of course, she doesn't have an iPhone.
True.
But this will work with any web browser, too.
Right. This does work with any web browser.
And have you enjoyed the experience of developing on an iPhone?
To be honest, I was having more fun trying to figure out Spanish.
Yeah.
Just saying, okay, what things do I have to just give up on and say, this is an irregular verb, you know, this is...
Really write this
ser
rule.
Ser is not like any other verb.
Which verb?
Ser.
And what does that mean?
To be. It's
to be.
Okay. One of the first verbs you learn. But it's not a regular verb. And so having to go through all of that.
Okay, let's jump to international news with translation. What happened with Babel? First, what is Babelfish?
Babelfish is a translation software. It was originally associated with AltaVista. And that one, basically, and linguists would tell you this for years, whenever you try to translate from one language to another, you may be able to do word for word, but you lose the context.
Mm-hmm.
And context is everything when speaking in other languages, or in your own language, for that matter. And so while it's great for just trying to get the gist of an article, you never use it for official correspondences.
Right. And in fact, translation, if you can think of language as an art form, translation is an art. There's no science to it. I mean, there's, of course, some rules you can do, but basically you have to have a person interpreting one meaning into another, and that's why translators are so invaluable. So trying to automate that process, you lose the meaning in the language. That's the basic problem. So Babelfish tries to fix that somehow with a lot of software. Is that right?
Right.
And it makes mistakes?
Yes, it does. And so, for example, a Dutch foreign minister heading off for a business trip or a diplomatic trip used Babelfish for his official correspondence to his destination. And the beginning of the email that he wrote, or translated email, read, "Hello, bud. Enclose five of the questions in honor of the foreign minister. The mother, your visit in Israel is a sleep to the favor or to the bed your mind on the conflict are Israel-Palestinian."
Did he speak this?
So, obviously, this is not what he had in mind and is not what he wanted to come out. And this is the dangers of Babelfish and other ones similar to
what
that.
What was he trying to say? Do you know?
Not that.
Babelfish is good to give you the gist of what is being said.
Yeah, exactly.
But don't take the literal translation.
Although Google has been making some good strides with their translation software in that they're not trying to do it word for word.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing it based on a probability. Whenever you have one set of, in one language, this type of thing occurring, and it shows up in another language, like a translated web pages, for example,
mm-hmm.
then you work on a probability, not doing it word for word. They're seeing patterns.
A sampling.
Trying to show those patterns. And so they have been getting some good results, although it still suffers from the same thing that you don't want to have an official correspondence done by it.
You know, you see a lot, I've been seeing other samples of trying to do artificial intelligence by looking at large data sets of human done work and emulating the similarities. So David Cope, who's a professor emeritus in music at UCSC, we've had on the show a few years ago, he has algorithmic music composition stuff. Mm-hmm. And the way he does it in a general sense, it's complicated, of course, mathematically, but also musically complicated. He takes a large library of music and then sees, like from one composer, Bach, and then he'll see how Bach normally does note patterns, and then he'll emulate that same thing, and he can produce Bach that sounds like Bach. But it's similar to this idea of, let's take, you know, 5,000 things that have been said in these two languages. We know these are good translations because humans did it. When these words showed up, then these words showed up in the other language. And that's the way that it was done.
Yeah, and as a side note, if anyone wants to hear about that story where we talk about music being generated by composers that are now long dead, we have that in our archives. By all means, head over to geekspeak.org and download the show.
Nice. Do we have that in the archive? That was a long time ago.
Yeah, we do.
Did you listen to it? Okay. I don't know.
Well,
if it's there.
I'm pretty sure. It was after Mitnick, and Mitnick was our first one that we had a recording.
That's true. Years ago. Wow. Yes, geekspeak.org. Full of stuff. Even I lose track of thousands of hundreds and hundreds of shows. We just passed our 7th year mark in September.
Oh, my God.
August.
August. August. Oh, that was a long time ago. Yeah, you and I, the three of us have been doing this for that long.
No, actually, I started a couple of weeks after you guys. It was you, Sean, and John.
But a couple of weeks after?
Yeah.
You're still 7 years in, man. You're still waking up.
You're here since the beginning.
You're still a sucker. All right, let's go to the next news story. And that's a clear translation, by the way. Thank you, Miles, for that. Sean, what's up?
You know, I was not online all week.
Oh, sorry. Cyril, the Alps are nice at night.
I heard that, Google is coming off the cell phone, or maybe not.
Cell phone software.
See, I don't know. I got to go look it up. It just sounded interesting.
Wait. But at the same time, I don't want to talk about it because I haven't seen it. I don't know if anyone's actually seen it.
Something about Android. They've made Androids to build these things. No. The software's called Android. I'm kidding. That's my what my so mind been, wants to hear.
There's been a large idea that Google would be producing a cell phone, a full cell phone. Yeah. And there's been like this underground idea. And then, of course, when they were trying to get spectrum for the government, they were bidding on it. They wanted it to be open spectrum. There's all this blah, blah, blah. And so now they're beginning clear that they're doing an operating system for a cell phone.
Actually, I heard this in Germany. I guess they're working with a German company to bring this out first.
So, I mean, isn't there already software packages that are phone environments? I mean, I've got a smartphone, which is a Java-based thing. Apple's got something that runs it on a cell phone. Is this a real need? Is there not an open standard for cell phone operating systems?
We should get Google on the phone on the show.
And talk
I think we should go find a spokesperson and talk to them about this. I'd like to learn more.
Well, you have Windows CE, which has...
But that's not really a phone software, right? That's dedicated for a personal device.
Yeah, but I mean that's kind of the difference between a cell phone and a PDA is very much blurring.
Yeah,
I mean, let alone the iPhone that I have in front of me. I mean, it's
right.
It's,
but the samples that you're going to bring up for personal devices / phones is Palm Source and CE.
I don't know. Palm Source is definitely falling behind.
They're all falling behind. Right, they're all kind of like not really.
Windows CE is out there, but it has some stability issues.
Yeah,
but you know that's fine. It's not Systran. I was thinking of the translation software. Symbian.
Symbian, right, which is the thing that's on my phone.
Right, which is more mature, but it's also apparently a lot harder to write software for, mm-hmm. to configure. Then you have Java, which has a mixed audience.
Isn't Symbian Java?
No.
No, oh, no. I'm sorry.
Although you can have a Java virtual machine run on top of Symbian.
Oh, okay.
And then there are some phones out there that are just supposed to be a Java OS. Or small devices.
Well, I think that Sean's assumption is we need to get somebody on the show with an expert on this. I think it's a good idea. Let's go on.
I'm reading CNET, and they said Google officially unveiled Android, the new mobile phone software, during a press conference on Monday.
Right.
And they're working with 34 companies on the Open Handset Alliance that will work on developing applications on the Android platform.
That's cool.
All right. And yet, try as I might, I can't see a single screenshot for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, really.
It's just a press release so far.
Okay. Let's go on to the next news story. Miles, I'm going to go to you. And I'd like to ask, if you don't mind, tell me a little bit about Radiohead and their music selling or giving away thing that went online.
The very popular band Radiohead, who has been a top seller in terms of music sales.
Do you listen to Radiohead?
I've heard their songs. Yeah. I don't have any of their albums, but I've definitely heard their songs. It's impossible to miss if you listen to any popular music. And they made a big splash by saying, okay, we're going to release our next album totally online for download. And in addition to that, it's not just, okay, come to our website and pay us $5 or $20 or however much they want to sell for it. They actually opened up a website to say you can pay as much or as little as you want.
Yeah, they did this about a month ago, right?
Right.
Maybe a little longer.
Right.
They actually have data about this now?
Yes, they have data about
this
now.
I want to hear how this
works. So let me get this straight.
You can go up there. Could you get it? Could you download it without any money?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay,
well, so. 1 cent. I think it was.
Oh, really? You actually had to pay at least 1 cent.
I'm not sure, actually.
Well, then that doesn't make sense on the download percentages that you're about to share with us. It has to be some.
Okay,
then
it might
be able to download for free as well.
Sure.
But so the idea was that they're going to let the users choose how much they want to pay.
Right. How much is Radiohead, and how much do you want to support them?
Kind of like public radio.
Yeah, very much like public radio. And as it turns out, Radiohead has made $6 to $10 million.
On this
on
album.
Their album, yes. Which, that's not having to go through all the CD channels and all
unlike
the
unlike public radio.
Right.
Wait, they've made it directly.
Right, so not going through any retailers, not having to have the middleman take out the little pieces and how much it costs to make a CD. This is straight money going to the band.
No music association.
Right.
Hmm.
And the average price that was being paid, apparently, is between $5 and $8.
Oh, people were spending.
People were actually spending the money for it, and this is in addition to they will be releasing a CD later,
right?
And so getting it from that channel as well. But it's turned into being this great example of how you can make money as a band.
Do they know how many people paid versus didn't pay? I mean, that's a lot of money, and the average being $5 or $5 to $8. That's pretty good. Is there an idea of how many people just got it for free?
Let's see here.
You gave me this
the significant percentage was willing to pay between $8 and $12.
Okay.
The largest percentage, 17%, paid less than $4. But so only 17% decided that it wasn't worth all that much.
It's interesting.
I'm sorry, of those that paid.
Okay.
only 38% of total downloaders paid for the album.
Ah, so there it is. There's the 61%.
Yeah, so 62% didn't pay. But still, even with that, they're still making far more money than
I think. I mean, I still think that, I mean, for percentages on people that are paying, that's actually, I mean, if you're using the model of public radio, which survives pretty much everything from people's donations, that's a higher percentage of listeners, if you will, than we have on public radio that actually participate.
Certainly.
I think we're at 20% or something.
Yeah, if 30% of KUSP's audience gave $10, I think...
Wait, let's not get into that, because that was last month. if you want to donate to KUSP, we'd love the offer. You can go to KUSP.org. Okay, anyway, so 38% of the people, even though they didn't have to, paid money, and most of those people paid up to $5
right,
for the new album. I think that's pretty cool. I think I'm going to go try to do that. One thing that I think is...
Are you going to download it?
I think I'll go and pay for it and download it, yeah.
The curious thing about I haven't heard anybody talk about how much they like the songs. So I'm wondering how much of this is novelty, how much of this is people saying, yes, this is what we want music to be like.
Yeah.
And how much is... I expect Radiohead to be really good music, and I'm going to...
I have one of their albums, and it took me a while to get into it, but wow, when you do, it's really cool. Maybe
now you're just saying that because they're doing this cool thing with music.
they're not your typical band.
That's true. I am in this feeling where I wish micropayments exist, because I would like to have my music player keep track of what I'm listening to, and then go, okay, and have all the music available to me that I want in the world, right? So I play it. As I play it, I kind of keep track of what I've played in the week, and I can look in it and say, oh, look, I did like this song, and I can rate it up. And then just assign the amount of money I want to give to musicians every month, and then have it just send it off based on what I'm listening to.
That'd be great. I'd love that for cable TV. I want access to everything.
Uh-huh. But only pay for what you watch?
Pay for what I watch.
Yep. Or give a certain amount of money goes to whatever you happen to watch. So you say, you know, television's worth $10 a month to me, and
there needs to be something.
Something like that.
Because most of the channels, you know, I don't get. Yet, I still have to go through them and see those messages say, I'm sorry, you don't get this channel. But to order it, you know,
right.
Come on. That's got to change.
That does.
But, I'd like to see, there's got to be some big changes with music. Everybody knows it's got to happen. And slowly things are happening. But there needs to be an easier way to get access to it.
No, we were just talking about Google's phone. We clearly don't know enough about it. But about cell phones, Miles, you were telling me something kind of cool that jamming cell phones is happening more. What's going on with that?
Cell phone jamming is on the rise.
Is it easy to jam a cell phone?
Well, yes, what does this mean? Like make it inoperable?
Yeah, you have a little device that basically floods the frequencies with noise.
Uh-huh.
And it's kind of like if you don't want someone to talk, like just you and I talking to one another.
Oh, I just pull your mic down like that. See?
Well, you can stop me from being heard over the airs, but we're about
complete
4
control.
Feet away from each other. And we can.
And you could hit me if you want.
Right. Mm-hmm. How do we get someone to how would someone get us to stop talking to one another? Well, you bring a big speaker over and you blast noise so that you can't be heard, can't understand one another, kind of like being at a loud party. Well, this is much the same thing that's going on now with these small devices that are blocking cell phones. Is they're using the same frequencies that cell phones are using, but blasting a loud output from of noise.
So it's not damaging the cell phone or the cell phone tower. It's just making them not work when that noise is happening.
Exactly,
it makes it too hard to communicate. All right.
However, it is illegal.
Oh.
It's illegal to do so.
An FCC regulation, of course.
FCC regulations. Sure. You are not allowed to put out interference just at will.
Right.
And so there's this whole back and forth of people getting angry with cell phone users for using it in the theater, or because a lot of times theater owners are trying to use it, or you'll be in a restaurant, you don't want to hear someone yakking away on a cell phone.
So what are people doing? They're bringing these little portable devices, and anytime the cell phone starts annoying them, they just turn it off. They just hit this button, and they can't use the cell phone around them?
Exactly. I'm
sorry, that's kind of cool.
Yes,
I know it's illegal,
and
it's
at the same time,
ethical, maybe, but
I am
cool.
Curious though as to when the first time, and this is covered on some discussions online, is. What happens when someone needs to make a 911 call and one of these jammers is in place?
Right.
And then you find out who the jammer is. Let's say at a theater when they're jamming.
You hit them with FCC regulation fines.
But are they liable for, you know, manslaughter because someone couldn't make a safety call? Like someone died because they couldn't get through with 911.
Well, I'm assuming that you're stopping an emergency effort. I mean, it would be similar to pulling your car in front of a fire truck and trying to stop them physically. It'd be similar, right? What are the regulations against that? I would assume that's the same laws that would be in place, right?
Sure.
Okay.
But I mean, I guess when you're saying like, that's really cool, there is that
other
side.
Very, very bad, yeah.
To watch out for.
Yeah. Well, it's a radius thing though, too. I mean, if it's only 20 feet radius and I know nothing bad's happening there, of course, yeah. Yeah, not that cool. Okay, fine. You're right, I'm wrong.
Well, yeah, I think of movie theater. Do you know what's going on in the theater next to you, okay, other than the big bass booms?
But couldn't they just do a Faraday cage around the movie theater? So when they build a movie theater, just produce a Faraday cage, no signals are going in and out, and boom. Problem solved. Or they could even spend more money on insulation so that you can't hear the movie theater next to you. That'd be even better. Because you can slap the person next to you that's talking on the phone. You can't do anything about the movie next door.
Right.
GeekSpeak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley, offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, notary public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. How do you guys say notary public? I've been doing this for years.
Notary public. Notary public.
Public.
See, I always, when I was younger, actually prior to this actually being written in front of me for 7 years, I always thought it was notary republic.
No.
Yeah. I really thought it was. So it's notary public.
It's
so
not it's a republic.
So it's a public notary.
Someone who would take note of your business transactions or something that you need to have witnessed, and they are available to the public.
Could
they
I call them a public notary?
Should that, it be you, know, you could call him that. It just wouldn't be correct.
It sure sounds clear.
This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. We're taking calls with questions and comments of technology. I'm going to give you the phone numbers in just a second. Just want to remind you that in the air with me is Miles Elam and Sean Cleveland. We can handle any question you possibly bring at us. Rick Philman's waiting to take your calls. And the phone numbers are 476-2800. Again, 476-2800. Toll free at 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-KUSP. How easy is that? And if you want to send us an email, you're welcome to do so. Just go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us.
KUSP co-sponsors the UCSC Arts and Lectures presentation of Caetano Veloso, Friday, November 16th at 8 p.m. at the Santa Cruz Civic Auditorium. One of the most renowned figures in contemporary Brazilian music, Veloso presents a fusion of Brazilian pop, rock, and avant-garde that influences modern music all over the world. He will be performing music from his new CD, continuing his unique mix of bossa nova, tango, and rock. For more information and tickets, please call 459-2159 or go online to santacruztickets.com.
Thank you very much, Sean.
Yeah.
Stay tuned today on KOSP for Castle Cottage this morning at 11 a.m. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. That was Sean Cleveland. We also have Miles Elam. And Rick Philman is waiting to take your calls with questions and comments of technology. We'll pipe you on air. We'll try to help you out. We'll definitely answer your questions, maybe not correctly, but give it a shot. The phone numbers are 476-2800, 476-2800, toll free at 1-800-655-KUSP. Geek Speak on KUSP is supported by Cruise.io, providing local internet services including DSL, computer care, classes, and website builders. Information about Cruise.io memberships available online at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301. While we wait for calls to come in, actually we do have some calls, but we'll have them in a second. Miles, next news story. One more news story from you, sir.
Sure. What happens when chemists go into the kitchen? Some professional chefs are... for example, a restaurant known as WD-40 in New York City.
Oh my gosh.
Are taking different additives, food additives, and doing some amazing things like, for example, butter that doesn't melt in the oven, foie gras that you can tie into knots.
Wait.
Fried mayonnaise.
Wait, why is butter that doesn't melt in the oven a good thing?
Why would you want to fry mayonnaise?
Why would you want to eat butter that doesn't melt?
Some of these examples may
be... Why would you want to eat mayonnaise at all?
Something you're not, you know, something you're not looking for. But at the same time, you're able to do things that normally aren't possible according to normal chemistry, normal physics in the kitchen.
Well, normal kitchen
stuff.
It's
like a fried cube of mayonnaise. Is that what the picture I'm looking at your screen is?
I hope that's the butter.
Yes. Is that the butter?
Okay. That's nasty.
Let me see, Miles. Show me the fried mayonnaise.
Just think about a cube of breaded, you know, fried bread, but it's not bread.
Why do you want to fry mayonnaise? I don't understand. But wait.
The primary thing they're using is a hydrocolloid.
There you
go. I got to tell you.
These are things like xanthan gum, some other things that I don't know because I'm not a cook as well. So
when we were in Italy last week, my boss took a piece of toast and piled a bunch of turkey on it, and he took a bite out of it, and he goes, "Oh, this isn't turkey." One of the Italian PR reps there said, oh, that's lardo. It's pure lard. Just sliced. It looks like turkey.
Why would you eat that?
Well, you know. That's what they eat there.
Why would you eat a Twinkie? Like, seriously, couldn't you see someone else coming to American culture and saying, why would you eat this? This, you know, this yellow thing with a white gooey stuff in the middle. Like.
All right, we're going to start taking some calls. From Santa Cruz, John, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi, thanks a lot. Well, before I, my question, I wanted to comment quickly about your cell phone discussion and Faraday cages. Just, I actually work at the physics department at Cabrillo, and we play around with uses making a demonstration about Faraday cages, and we stick a cell phone in a little wire cage. And it's actually really amazing how well cell phones do work in Faraday cages. They, I guess maybe because they're digital or something, they just get like a just a teeny little signal, and they still work.
Can they send as well?
That I haven't tried. We usually just put one in there and we call it, and it rings. And we
wait
go, okay.
A second. Wait a second. You're a physics guy?
Yeah.
Okay. So, how is that working? I mean, a Faraday cage should be a free floating ground point that sucks up all the electrons, right? So you shouldn't have noise going through that cage. Maybe the cage needs to be larger, physically larger.
I don't. Well, maybe so.
Or more
maybe,
mass or something.
There's skin depth issues. There's size of the cage. There's all sorts of. It's one of those things we still play with because it's.
I wonder
it's
if
baffling us to go. Gosh, that shouldn't happen. If we put it in tinfoil, then it doesn't ring. But if you put it in like
a cage
like
yeah.
with a half a centimeter squares, then it.
So you're saying if I take the local movie theater and I just circle it with aluminum foil, eventually the cell phones wouldn't go through?
I think so, but if you circled it with chicken wire, they would. Or right. You could circle like window screen or some aluminum window screen. Even
that's small.
Prevent a cell phone from ringing.
You know, okay, can you do me a favor? Can you try doing another Faraday? Do a double layer, same material that's separated. So you have two Faraday cages that aren't touching each other. That
I'll
should
do it,
probably do it. And call us back. No, John, what's your question?
My question is, I've got my computer hard drive has gotten really noisy, and I am deciding that that's one, it just bugs me to death, and two,
what does it sound like?
It kind of sounds like a loud. I thought it was a loud computer fan at first, and then I realized that it was not a fan; it was the hard drive.
Does it only make the noises when you're writing to it, or reading from it?
No, the whole time.
How do you know it's the hard drive?
Because I stopped both fans and opened up the case and put my ear near the hard drive, and that's where it seemed like it was coming from.
Now, is it also near your optical drive? Because those can be loud, too.
Optical drives normally make that
kind of noise. No, it's just a regular old...
It is the hard drive.
Regular old traditional hard drive, yeah.
I don't know how it would be making that kind of noise. It does not sound good. Because basically there's no parts that touch each other in the rotational process.
Well, they shouldn't be touching each other.
Well, then your computer would not be working if they were touching each other.
No, there's a chance it's a CD... CD-ROM.
Because the CD-ROM
right.
will spin.
Right
sometimes,
next.
Yes.
Yeah. What you can do is just...
A ROM. There's nothing in the CD-ROM.
No, that's okay. It still does it sometimes. It's really
okay. Maybe I should check it out.
Just yank the power on that.
Yank the power
on
your
cable.
Optical drive. I bet it is.
Can you leave the IDE cable in the optical drive when you pull the power?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so leave it all plugged in except for the power lines, and then try your machine, and I bet it will be quiet. And
well,
then
unplug the CD-ROM. Drive,
just the power to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the other ribbon cable, you don't want to unplug that and plug it back.
Okay, so yeah, my question was how to best get my data off my hard drive into another hard drive. But
that's a totally valid question. Don't just do this. Also figure out a backup solution. So it probably would behoove you to get a USB external hard drive.
I did, actually. I bought a hard drive.
Okay.
And do you want to make
I haven't bought the enclosure yet, but my idea is to have that.
Do you just want to back up data? Or do you actually want to make a completely? You want to clone the drive?
I would like to clone. I've got a whole bunch of programs and everything all set up just the way I want them. I'm really not looking forward to doing that all over again. So I'd kind of like to just kind of
if you're not concerned about fire. I mean, all the geeks have had multiple drives in their computers for a long time, and I've never lost any data by having like my machine completely get destroyed, which is a concern. And that's why you'd want an external drive because then you can store them in two different locations. But if you're not really concerned about that as much, and I might do it this way, just take that hard drive and add it to your computer and then do a clone on it in that way. That way, it's already attached to your machine. And if it doesn't... I mean, that's so it's inside your machine. You don't have to get the USB external case.
Yeah, I personally...
Well, I kind of like the idea of getting... I've got actually... In the machine now, I have an extra hard drive that
okay,
I've been using for data, music, and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was thinking about using that one as my main operating system drive, and then I bought another drive for my music and stuff to use as an external drive.
Okay, so, well, the process to do this, Sean, go for it.
I use Norton Ghost, and I do it outside of the OS. So I have a little bootable USB drive with the DOS version of Norton Ghost on it. And then I usually with any PC computer, when you first turn the computer on and you see the post screen, it tells you what your CPU is, how much memory you have.
Yeah.
Right then you want to go to your boot menu. It's usually maybe F12 or F8 or the escape key. It'll tell you.
Yeah.
And if you've got a bootable USB drive in there or a floppy even, it'll fit on a floppy, you tell it to boot to that device, and then you run Ghost, and then make sure you have both hard drives connected, and you can clone it that way.
Okay. And it'll find your drives, and it'll say, where do you want to clone it to?
Yeah, it'll ask you which drive.
Drive D, and it'll say, okay, great. Okay.
You specify the source drive and the destination. Yeah, it's a little more advanced, I guess. I do it all the time. I have many different images for different types of computers.
And that's the imaging software, Norton Ghost.
Yeah,
you know
that's what
much
I pretty
that,
much use. I don't, because I use a corporate version.
Yes. So if you don't want to do that, there is a backup utility inside Windows that will do the same thing, but it doesn't have... I wouldn't say that you'd be able to boot from that USB drive. You'd have to install your OS again on a new hard... Let's say your hard drive failed. You have to install a new OS on a new hard drive, then plug in your USB drive, or install Windows on it completely, and then plug in the USB drive that you've done the Microsoft backup on, and then do a restore. And you'd still have an operating system. It would be a lot... You know, it would still work like your old machine did, but you couldn't do just a boot from. The thing that Sean's talking about, the ghosting idea, is that you have a second copy of the entire hard drive. If everything fails, you just you turn off your machine, you pull the broken hard drive out, you take this one that you've ghosted, plug it in, and the machine just works again. So it's a really...
But I could do it now if I don't wait for it to fail. I could do it with the one that's working now. Assuming it's noisy, I could just...
Yeah.
Open it up and run it and say,
yeah,
copy everything.
That's true. You could just do Norton Ghost or this Microsoft solution and do it.
Or the Windows backup.
Yeah, you can.
I think Seagate Drives comes with a utility called cTools that allows you to clone your drive. So if you were to go buy a new, faster Seagate drive, I'm pretty positive they've got the tool that allow you to move your existing operating system and all your data over to the new drive. And I wouldn't be surprised if... other
Western Digital
had it too. Yeah, you might want to go look into that.
And in doing that if you're a computer user, you can kind of think of changing hard drives like changing tires on your car. Your tires you can just ride your car until your tires explode, and then you might get an accident. And that's similar to what you're doing when you're using a computer with a hard drive. It's going to fail eventually. So having a cycle where every once in a while you change the hard drive out is a good thing to do. Maybe a 2-year cycle or less.
Yeah.
Now, it's not guaranteeing you won't have a blow up, but at least you're
so I just want to let you know
that your space requirements just kind of dictate that too. After
that's,
a while,
that's true.
Yeah, usually you swap out your drive because space requirements. But if your drive starts making this clicking noise or is not sounding normal, that's a good sign that it's on its last leg. Okay. The optical drive will make this whirring sound, and it'll keep going. And it just drives. So that's probably your optical drive spinning. It could mean that the drive is failing, or it could mean that you've got a disk in there that can't be read.
Okay.
So take out the disk. It could mean that the cable that you have connected to it is not connected properly.
Okay.
Or it's failing, so you might want to replace that.
You know, the good thing with optical drives that are failing is they're really inexpensive, and when you buy a new one, you get a better everything, a double-layer DVD burner, everything.
You know what?
Yeah.
And they're under $50, really.
Okay.
Go to this is what I do. You'd be surprised. You can bring an optical drive back to life and make it actually a better drive than it ever was before. And it's really simple. When you're in Windows Explorer, right-click on the drive letter of your optical drive and go to Properties and find out what the name of the drive, what the model number is for that drive.
Yeah.
Do a Google search on that model drive, number, and then put a space firmware.
Firmware.
Go download the newest firmware for that and update it. And you'll be surprised. You can make your drive much better than it was before.
Cool. Great. Okay.
Especially if it's having a problem reading disks, burned disks.
Yeah, I have.
Because those firmwares, they add compatibility.
John, thank you so much for the call.
Disk.
I know we handled a lot more than you actually asked
about.
No,
it's all been great.
All right.
So one last thing is that will the Windows backup utility do just as good a job as Norton Ghost?
It operates differently.
Yeah.
There are some open source alternatives. There's something called Partition Image, and there's Ghost for Unix. So you can look for, like in Google, looking for a free Ghost alternative or Open Ghost, and it'll show you some alternatives if you want to try those. I haven't used them
Like you're not recommending the Windows backup.
Yeah, because Windows is using files that are in use, and making copies of those files that are in use can often be problematic.
An additional thing, when you're imaging a whole drive, especially when the hard drive's like going down,
you don't want to be using the drive.
You don't want to be in it. Yeah, exactly. You don't want to be using the drive while you're doing it. So an external thing. Thank you, John, for the call.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye. In Live Oak, we have Steve now on GeekSpeak. Steve, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi, Lyle. Hi, guys. I've called to talk about some bad advice you guys gave me a couple of weeks ago.
Okay, let me just take you out then. Bye-bye. No, I'm just kidding, Steve.
But before that, I just want to ask you a quick question. Have you ever asked Babelfish to translate itself?
Yeah, it's hilarious.
Yeah, what it did is it came back, because we were advising some relatives in Italy about using it. We translated it back, and it translated itself back from Italian as fish of confusion, to which now my wife and I always refer to Babelfish as the fish of confusion.
That's great.
It's very appropriate.
That's great.
Okay, what we were talking about 2 weeks ago was the difficulties I was having transferring my files from my Mac to the PC.
Sure.
And let's go down the list. One of the suggestions I had to take care of the problem that when I move them over, or it wouldn't move over because I'd get that message, file name's too long or bad symbols in it, is that I create an archive and transfer the archive.
And?
Well, the archive transfer is great, but when you decompress the archive...
what tool are you using on the Windows to decompress the archive?
Whatever it is when you double-click on the archive file. Which is whatever Windows, whatever Vista has built into it, which is, I think, unzip. I think it's zip.
I've never.
What it does is it
tries
to.
Are you making a tar file on the Mac?
I'm sorry?
Is it a tar file?
No, a zip file.
It's a zip file on the Mac.
Right. But what I'm saying is that it transfers fine, but when you go to open it, what it does is it says, all right, we're going to unload these files, and then, but what it's doing is it's actually a copy operation. So
and it doesn't.
It tries to copy one of these file names, it stops.
Okay, so the problem is that we weren't aware enough of how Vista's zip utility works.
Right. Yeah. It wouldn't because it basically decompresses and then copies the file into a folder. And as soon as it tries to copy the folder, the bad symbols.
That's funny because the zip application should make sure that it abides the rules of the file system it's decompressing into.
Yeah. You use that word should.
Yeah. Exactly.
Okay.
Next solution. We gave you lots of solutions. So
yes, you gave me lots of solutions. The next solution was you gave me several things to look into on my Mac to try and figure out why, even though I could pick up, I could look at my files on my Vista computer on the Mac, on my Vista computer, I couldn't see the Mac. And I went into file sharing, and I turned on all those things in the system preferences, and my Vista computer still will not see the Mac.
Are you using the Mac through wireless? No, because you got a Mac Mini, right?
Right, and my Mac Mini is hooked directly to my router. The laptop is through wireless.
Okay, but the Windows machine looking at the laptop's through wireless. Okay,
yes.
So it's interesting the Mac can see the Windows and not the other way around.
Yeah, I know.
Are you on two different subnets? Do you know?
No.
Okay, you're on the same. You have the IP ranges are very similar.
Yep.
Only the last octet's different. Okay.
Yes.
And so still turning that on, Vista couldn't see it.
What it does is it gets to the point to log in. And when you try and put in a name and a password, it comes back and it changes. You put in a computer name and the password, and it comes back with when you say okay or whatever it is. It comes back with the name of the laptop.
Right. And you change the Macintosh machine name as we suggested to something short with no spaces in it.
Yes.
And it still didn't work.
No.
You know, Steve, I've known you most of my life, and you call and. Couldn't you just called me at home and said, Lyle?
Because you're not tech support. I thought other people could
benefit from our stupidity. Thank
but
you.
But let me tell you what did work.
Oh, good, you have a solution. Yay!
What did work is if you can remember the last thing what I had been doing was using just a flash drive to transfer the files, but it's taking forever to load them on. Well, apparently, what I told you last week something was wrong. I must have had it in I must have been using the keyboard port or something because when I plugged it directly in. To a USB 2 port, it loaded the flash drive up much faster.
Good.
Right, fast. Okay. So that's good. So this doesn't take me several hours.
So you're saying one thing we told you was right.
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
And and if you can, if when you're at home, you've got my number, if you can think of some way to let my, there's two issues still open. One is why I can't see the Mac on my Vista machine, and that's a tech support thing. But the other thing is, one way or the other, why this issue exists about the file names. You would think, we would think that at this point in computer history, the file name issue would have gone away a long time ago.
I mean, especially Vista, right? You're going into Vista. It should be able to handle this. Yeah.
Use that word again.
Should be. Should. Okay, what I'm going to do is try to... I mean, the thing is, here's a question for you. Can you take those files and copy them between two different locations on your Mac?
Yes.
Yeah. Weird.
They're just file names that have, like, a date in it, like today's date, you know, sure. Slash marks, you know,
And you have all the latest updates on your VistaBox?
Of course. Yeah. It does it automatically, all the time, constantly.
Maybe you should wait for Service Pack 1 from Vista and then try it again. I'm sorry, but I bet there's some truth there.
Yeah. Well, and the other option, of course, is to get like a third party zip application. Like I use WinZip and
I
try
use
that
instead. WinRAR.
WinRAR is good too.
WinRAR is, I think.
And which one is it?
It's WinRAR. WinRAR.
WinRAR.
So RAR is a better compression scheme than zip, but it supports zip too.
Now, is this something that you have to put on both computers?
No.
It's just an unzip.
Yeah, actually, the algorithms for zipping is actually kind of known. But
you
do, so anybody can kind of implement a zip.
So this would go on the Vista machine to unzip.
Right. And theoretically name the names correctly for your operating system.
Okay. Well, tune in next week.
Thanks, Steve.
Okay. Thank you very much, guys. Right. Bye-bye.
All right. So I think we've got... I'm losing track of who's calling and what lines we're on. Steve was on line 2. All right, so this is another Steve. There we go. From Santa Cruz, second Steve. What's up?
Hey, hi. Good morning, geeks.
Morning.
Good show today.
Thanks.
I was thinking that after you had the Google spokesperson on, you could give the guys from Radiohead a call and see if they want to come on the show, too.
That would be awesome.
Has Radiohead been on KSP before, Steve? Do you know?
Live? I don't think so. I think it'd be a first.
Well, maybe we should get them on live at lunch, and then the geeks can talk about the technical side. All right.
Yeah, we could cross-promote the shows.
What's
it would
up,
be really great.
Yeah, it'd be good. What's up, Steve?
I've got a DVD burning question. It's a burning question.
On Macintosh?
Yeah, it's on a Mac. It's on G5. I'm using the internal burner. I'm backing up some data. I burned a couple DVDs, and it burns, it verifies, and then it won't read the disk.
The same machine won't read the disk?
Exactly.
But it verifies?
Yes.
That doesn't make any sense.
I know.
Next caller. No.
Well, my initial hit on it was that I checked the media speed, and it's like 17 times, which may be too new for the old burner that I've got in this Mac.
Yeah.
So it could just be that, but it seems strange that it would write and verify and then not read.
Does it take a long time to verify, longer than most DVDs?
Didn't notice.
Okay. And what are you burning in, the Finder, or are you using, like, Toast?
Toast.
Okay. So you could force the burner to be slower.
Right.
As a trial.
Right.
Are you using Dash R or Plus R material?
Dash.
Okay. Anybody has suggestions on why it would burn and verify and then not actually... Is it not mounting afterwards?
It doesn't mount.
Can you try it like on your laptop, the same DVD?
That's a good question. I haven't tried it on another machine yet.
Are you able to mount drives? Are you able to mount hard drives on this DVD?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it could be the...
I'm going to go with speed.
The actual blank media. Remember what I was talking about before?
That's true.
See if there's a new firmware for the drive.
Yeah, exactly. You might have given me a fix for that already.
Yeah.
Then again, on a Macintosh, getting a firmware upgrade is a little more difficult.
So what happens is all these media manufacturers have they own the dies they use, you know, and nobody wants to pay royalties on existing dies, so they make new ones, and those don't work in older optical drives.
Unless
you have to go get
firmware.
A new firmware to get support for that, and it's really bad.
It's interesting. It's interesting. I wonder if Toast is handling the dealing with that hard drive more directly, and the operating system, when it tries to do it directly, can't do it. Like, it can't modify. I mean, that's the thing that doesn't make any sense to me. In Toast, can you mount an image? You might want to try opening Toast and see if you can mount that CD for the Finder, because maybe that's the problem. But yeah, I would go with that it's a media solution, and I wouldn't... You could definitely try a different media type.
Mm-hmm. And the firmware. I mean, and then I was thinking I should just get a new burner that's faster anyway and does double layer or whatever.
Right, and it will probably come with the firmware you need. Though, be careful, because Apple's the Taurus, I'm not sure about the current state, when you put a new burner inside, sometimes the local applications like IDVD won't recognize that burner as something that will be valid for IDVD. That's an older solution. I haven't tried it, I don't know, since the G5 first came out. But
get an external burner.
You could get an external, but still the applications wouldn't.
Oh, really?
So it's just something, looking for another burner, it's just something I'm going to have to Google to death to make sure it's compatible.
Yeah. And one way to do it is, I think it's a Mitsubishi that seems to normally be pretty compatible.
Right.
Thank you, Steve, for the call.
Thanks a lot, guys.
So two Steves, call up, and I don't know. We don't seem so on top of it today. Or I should say, I don't. You're always great, Sean.
Yeah, what do you mean, me, pale face?
What was that?
Are you growing a beard again, Will?
Yeah, I'm growing a beard. Yeah, you guys look like, well, Miles, you got a beard. I didn't know you were old enough to grow a beard.
I was talking to Miles.
Yeah, Sean, you're definitely old enough.
Bang. In January, I will be reaching a milestone. So
you're going to be 40?
Yeah.
I remember a couple of years ago, someone came up and was like, wow, you do the Geek Speak? I thought you guys were kids.
Wait.
Like, no, we're not.
Sean, you're only 40?
Hey, I love you, Miles. Never would have thought. 40 is the new 30.
From Hollister. Lucia, welcome to Geek Speak.
Good morning.
Oh, can you speak up a little bit?
Oh. First, I want to ask you, how does somebody reach you via email? Is it only during the show that you check your email?
Yeah, we check the email kind of all the time, but we're all volunteers and we all have other jobs, and so sometimes we don't respond.
Yeah.
I take it you sent us an email and we didn't respond to you?
About 2 months ago.
Oh, no. Okay, what's the question?
I'm taking a class on Saturdays, and so I can't listen except for today. I'm sick, so I'm home, and I happen to catch your show. But the reason that I'm calling you is to ask you about video editing. I have Windows XP, and I have a mini camcorder, and I've converted them. Long story here. The FireWire cable, the port on my camcorder, doesn't work. So what I have to do is I have to attach the camcorder to my TV, VCR, DVD burner.
Right.
So I make a DVD on that, and then I bring it to my computer to try to do the editing.
Yeah, burning the DVD that your computer DVD burner is making, your home system, is not a very easy thing to edit on a computer. You actually have to, like, what's called ripping the data off of the disk to make, like, an MPEG, and it's a little more complicated. The computer you have doesn't have FireWire, or you haven't been able to make it work?
It has it, but I didn't start trying to fool around with it until just before the warranty expired. And so then when I called Sony to ask him about, why this wasn't working, this and that, they'd say, well, try this, and then...
Okay, Lucia, we're running out of time on GeekSpeak. Can I put you on hold, and I'll get you as soon as we go off air? Is
sure.
that cool?
All There's right. a lot of things.
Yeah,
it could be a BIOS. Maybe it's just not even turned on.
Actually, you know what? Why don't you call us back the same number in about 7 minutes, and I'll help you out.
Seven minutes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye. All right.
Yeah, when you're using ports on your computer, there's a good chance it's not even on a PC. So it's always good to go into your BIOS and check to make sure that FireWire is even enabled.
GeekSpeak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. Yeah, go ahead, Sean.
Tomorrow morning at 10 a.m. on This American Life. I love this show. It's the 20th anniversary of the death of the greatest politician you probably never heard of, someone funny and smart and inspiring to many people. A big city mayor who ran into problems most mayors never have to deal with. The amazing story of Harold Washington, a parable of race and politics in America. Tomorrow morning on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP.
That's Sean Cleveland. The other geek today was Miles Elam. I'm Lyle Troxell. Thank you all the geeks for participating. You just listened to another episode of GeekSpeak via our podcast. Would you do us a favor? Please go to your favorite podcasting index site, whether it be iTunes, Dig.com, Odeo, or another site, and write a review or give us a vote to let others know what you think about GeekSpeak. Thanks, that'd really help us out. GeekSpeak is supported by PreownedCar.com, PreownedCar.com, where anyone can post their vehicle for sale or browse to purchase a pre-owned car from other car owners. More information available at PreownedCar.com. This is Lyle Troxell for KUSP. Thanks for listening.